from her. He looked familiar, though Peter couldn't place him. "Mr. Jackson, it's good to see you." Sanchez stepped around her desk and extended her hand. "Madam President, it's an honor." "Please," she said, "it's Vicky. Let me introduce you to Ford Chase, my chief of staff."
"I believe we've met, Mr. Jackson."
Now, Peter remembered. Chase had attended the inquest after the destruction of the bridge on the oil road. The memory was unpleasant. He'd taken an instant disliking to the man. Compounding Peter's distrust, Chase was wearing a necktie, the most incomprehensible article of clothing in the history of the world.
"And of course you know General Apgar," Sanchez said.
Peter turned to see his former commanding officer rising from the couch. Gunner had aged a little, his clipped hair gone gray, his brow more deeply furrowed. A bit of a paunch stretched the buttons of his uniform. The urge to salute was strong, but Peter held it in check, and the two men shook.
"Congratulations on the promotion, sir."
To the surprise of no one who had served under the man, Apgar had been named General of the Army after Fleet had stepped down.
"I regret it every day. Tell me, how's your boy?"
"He's doing well, sir. Thanks for asking."
"If I wanted you to call me sir, I wouldn't have accepted your resignation. Which is my second biggest regret, by the way. I should have put up more of a fight."
Peter liked Gunner. The man's presence put him at his ease. "He wouldn't have done you any good." Sanchez led them to a small sitting area with a sofa and a couple of leather armchairs, surrounding a low table with a stone top, on which rested a long tube of rolled paper. For the first time, Peter had a chance to look at his surroundings. A wall of books, a curtainless window, a chipped desk piled high with paper. A pole stood behind it bearing the Texas flag, the only ceremonial object in the room. Peter took one of the chairs, across from Sanchez. Apgar and Chase sat to the side.
"To begin, Mr. Jackson," Sanchez said, "I'm sure you're wondering why I asked you to come see me. I'd like to request a favor. To put this in context, let me show you something. Fort."
Chase unrolled the paper on the table and weighed down the corners. A surveyor's map. Kerrville stood at the center, its walls and perimeter lines clearly marked. To the west, along the Guadalupe, three large areas were blocked off with crosshatching, each with a notation. SP1, SP2, SP3.
"At the risk of sounding grandiose, what you're looking at is the future of the Texas Republic," Sanchez said.
Chase explained, "SP stands for Settlement Parcel."
"These are the most logical areas for moving out the population, at least to start. There's water, arable soil in the bottoms, good land for grazing. We're going to proceed in stages, using a lottery system for people who want to leave."
"Which will be a lot of them," Chase added. Peter looked up. Everyone was waiting for his reaction.
"You don't seem pleased," Sanchez said.
He searched for the words.
"I guess I never really thought this day would come."
"The war is over," Apgar said. 3 years without a single viral. It's what we've been fighting for all these years."
Sanchez was leaning forward.
There was something tremendously attractive about the woman, an undeniable force. Peter had heard this about her. She was said to have been a great beauty in her youth, with a list of suitors a mile long. But it was an entirely different matter to experience it.
"History will remember you, Peter, for all you've done."
"It was more than just me."
"I know that, too. There's more than enough congratulations to go around."
"And I'm sorry about your friends.
Captain Donatio is a great loss.
And Amy, well..."
She paused.
"I'll be honest with you. The stories about her... I was never quite sure what to believe.
I'm not sure I completely understand them now.
What I do know is that none of us would be having this conversation if not for Amy. And for you. You're the one who brought her to us. That's what the people know. And it makes you very important. You could say there's no one like you. Her eyes remained fixed on his face. She had a way of making it feel as if they were the only two people in the room. Tell me, how do you like working for the Housing Authority? It's all right. And it gives you the chance to raise your boy, to be around for him. Peter sensed a strategy unfolding. He nodded. I never had children, Sanchez said, somewhat regretfully. One of the costs of the office. But I understand your feelings. So let me say right off that I'm sensitive to your priorities, and nothing about what I'm proposing would get in the way of that. You'll be there for him, just as you are now. Peter knew a half-truth when he heard one. On the other hand, Sanchez's approach was so carefully laid he couldn't help but admire it. I'm listening. What would you say, Peter, to joining my staff? The notion was so ludicrous, he almost laughed. Forgive me, Madam President. Please, the woman cut in with a smile. It's Vicky. He had to admit it. The woman was masterful. There's so much wrong with the idea, I don't even know where to begin. Just for starters, I'm not a politician. And I'm not asking you to be one. But you are a leader, and the people know it. You're too valuable a resource to sit on the sidelines. Opening the gate isn't just about making more room, though we absolutely need it. This represents a fundamental change in how we do just about everything. A lot of details have to be hammered out. But within the next 90 days, I'm planning to suspend martial law. The expeditionary is going to be recalled from the territories to assist with resettlement, and we'll be transitioning to a full civilian government. It's a big adjustment, giving everybody a place at the table, and it's going to be messy. But it absolutely has to happen, and this is the right moment. With all due respect, I don't see what this has to do with me. It has everything to do with you, actually. Or at least, I hope so. Your position is unique. The military respects you. The people love you, especially the Iowans. But those are only two legs of the tripod. The third is the trade. They're going to have a field day with this. Tifty Lamont may be dead, but your previous relationship with him gives you access to their chain of command. There's no question of shutting them down. We couldn't if we tried. Vice is a fact of life. An ugly fact, but a fact nonetheless. You know Dunk Withers, yes? Peter nodded. We've met. More than met, if what my sources tell me is correct. I've heard about the cage. That was quite a stunt. She was referring to Peter's first encounter with Tifty at his underground compound north of San Antonio. As a cathartic entertainment, members of the trade leadership would face off against virals in hand-to-hand combat, the others betting on the outcome. Dunk had gone into the cage first, dispatching a dopey with relative ease, followed by Peter, who had taken on a full-blown drac in order to secure Tifty's agreement to escort them to Iowa. It seemed like the thing to do at the time. Sanchez smiled. That's my point. You're a man who does what needs to be done. As for Dunk, the man's not half as smart as Lamont was, and I wish he were. Our agreement with Lamont was a simple one. The man was sitting on some of the best-preserved military hardware we'd seen in years. We couldn't have outfitted the army without him. Keep the worst stuff in check, we told him. Keep the guns and ammo coming, and you can go about your business. He understood the sense of it. But I doubt Dunk will. The man's a pure opportunist, and he has an ugly streak. So why not just put him in the stockade?
Sanchez shrugged.
We could, and it may come to that. General Apgar thinks we should round up the lot of them, seize the bunker and the gambling halls, and put an end to it. But somebody else would slide into his spot before the ink was dry, and we'd be back to square one. It's a case of supply and demand. The demand is there. Who will supply the goods? The card tables, the lick, the prostitutes? I don't like it, but I'd rather deal with a known quantity. And for now, that's Dunk.
So you want me to talk to him?
Yes, in time. Corralling the trade is important. So is keeping the military and the civilian population fully on board during the transition. You're the one man who has stock with all three. Hell, you could probably have my job if you asked for it. Not that I'd wish it on my worst enemy.
Peter had the unsettling feeling that he had already agreed to something. He looked at Apgar, whose face said, "Believe me, I've been down this road."
What exactly are you asking?
For now, I'd like to name you as a special advisor. A go-between, if you like, between the stakeholders. We can come up with a more specific title later. But I want you out in front, where everyone can see you. Your voice should be the first one people hear. And I promise you that you'll be home for supper every day with your boy.
The temptation was real. No more sweltering days swinging a hammer. But he was also tired. Some essential energy had left him. He'd done enough, and what he wanted now was a quiet, simple life. To take his boy to school and do a day of honest labor, and put his boy to bed at night and spend 8 sweet hours someplace else entirely. The only place where he had ever been truly happy.
No. Sanchez startled. She wasn't used to being denied so succinctly.
No.
That's it. That's my answer.
Surely there's something I can say that will change your mind.
I'm flattered, but this has to be somebody else's problem. I'm sorry.
Sanchez didn't seem angry, merely puzzled.
I see.
The disarming smile returned.
Well, I had to ask.
She rose to her feet, everyone else following suit. Now it was Peter's turn to be surprised. He realized he'd expected her to put up more of a fight. At the door, she shook his hand in parting.
Thank you for taking the time to meet with me, Peter.
The offer stands, and I hope you'll reconsider. You could do a lot of good. Promise me you'll think about it?
There seemed no harm in agreeing.
I'll do that.
General Apgar can show you out.
So that was it. He felt a little amazed, and wondered, as one always did when a door closed, if he had made the right choice.
Peter, one last thing, Sanchez said.
He turned at the threshold. The woman had returned to her desk.
I was meaning to ask, how old is your boy?
The question seemed harmless enough.
He's 10.
And it's Caleb, yes?
Peter nodded.
It's a wonderful age, his whole life ahead of him. When you stop to think about it, it's the children we're really working for, isn't it? We'll be long gone, but our decisions in the next few months will determine the kind of world they're going to live in.
She smiled.
Well, food for thought, Mr. Jackson. Thank you again for coming.
He followed Gunner out the door. Halfway down the hall, Peter heard the man chuckling under his breath.
She's good, isn't she?
Yeah, said Peter. She's good, all right.
10. Michael had 3 things in his bag. The first was the newspaper. The second was a letter. He had found it in the breast pocket of the captain's uniform. The envelope was unmarked. The man had never intended to send it. The letter, less than a page, was written in English. "My darling boy, I know now that you and I are never to meet in this life. Our fuel is nearly exhausted. Our last hope of reaching the refuge is gone. Last night, the crew and passengers took a vote. The result was unanimous. Death by dehydration is a fate none desires. Tonight will be the last we share on Earth. Entombed in steel, we will drift in the currents until such time as Almighty God chooses to take us to the bottom. I obviously have no hope that these last words will reach you. I can only pray that you and your mother have been spared the devastation and somehow survived. What awaits me now? The Holy Quran says, "To Allah belongeth the mystery of the heavens and the earth, and the decision of the hour of judgment is as the twinkling of an eye, or even quicker, for Allah hath power over all things. Surely we are His, and to Him we shall return. In spite of all that has happened, I have faith that my immortal soul will pass into His hands, and that when at last we meet, it shall be in paradise. My final thoughts in life are with you. Baraka Allahu Fika. Your loving father, Nabil." Michael mused on these words as he made his way through the streets of H-Town. He was accustomed to scenes of abandonment and devastation. He had crossed ruined cities that contained skeletons by the thousands. But never before had the dead spoken so directly to him. In the captain's quarters, he had found the man's passport. His full name was Nabil Haddad. He had been born in the Netherlands, in a city called Utrecht, in 1971. Michael found no further evidence of the boy in the cabin, no photographs or other letters. But the emergency contact named in his passport was a woman named Astrid Keeble, with a London address. Perhaps she was the boy's mother. Michael wondered what had happened between the three of them, that the captain never should have seen his son. Perhaps the boy's mother wouldn't allow it. Perhaps, for some reason, the man did not feel worthy. Yet he had felt the need to write to him, knowing that in a few hours he would be dead, and the letter would travel no farther than his own pocket. But that wasn't all the letter told him. The Bergensfjord had been going somewhere. It had had a destination. Not a refuge. The refuge. A safe haven where the virus could not reach them. Hence the third thing in Michael's bag, and his need for the man they called the Maestro. If the man had a real name, Michael didn't know it. The Maestro also had the habit of speaking in disconcertingly butchered sentences, while always referring to himself in the third person. It took some getting used to. He was quite old, possessing a sinewy twitchiness that made him seem less like a man than some kind of overgrown rodent. He had once been an electrical engineer for the civilian authority. Long retired, he had become Kerrville's go-to man for electronic antiquities. Crazy as a caged bird, and not a little paranoid. But the man knew how to make an old hard drive confess its secrets. The Maestro's shed was unmissable. It was the only building in H-Town with solar panels on the roof. Michael knocked loudly and stepped back for the camera. The Maestro wanted a good look at you first. A moment passed, and then a series of heavy locks opened. "Michael." The Maestro stood in a narrow wedge of open door, wearing a work apron and a plastic visor with flip-down lenses. "Hello, Maestro." The man's eyes darted up and down the street. "Quickly," he said, waving Michael inside. The shed's interior was like a museum. Old computers, office machines, oscilloscopes, flat panels, huge bins of handhelds and cell phones. The sight of so much circuitry always gave Michael a tingly thrill. "How can the Maestro be of assistance?" "I've got an antique for you." Michael removed the third thing from his bag. The old man took it in his hand and examined it quickly.
Genesis 872HJS, fourth generation, 3 terabytes, late pre-war.
He looked up.
Where?
I found it on a derelict ship. I need to recover the files.
A closer look, then.
Michael followed him to one of several workbenches, where he laid the drive on a cloth mat and flipped down the lenses of his visor. With a minuscule screwdriver, he removed the case and perused the interior parts.
Moisture damage. Not good.
Can you fix it?
Difficult. Expensive.
Michael removed a wad of Austin's from his pocket. The old man counted it on the bench.
Not enough.
It's what I've got.
The maestro doubts that. Oil man like yourself?
Not anymore. He studied Michael's face.
Ah, the maestro remembers.
He has heard some crazy stories.
True?
Depends on what you heard.
Hunting for the barrier. Sailing out alone.
More or less. The old man pursed his rubbery lips, then slid the money into the pocket of his apron.
The maestro will see what he can do. Come back tomorrow.
Michael returned to the apartment. In the meantime, he'd been to the library, adding a heavy book to his satchel, The Reader's Digest Great World Atlas. It wasn't one that people were permitted to check out. He'd waited for the reference librarian to be distracted, concealed it in his bag, and slipped outside. Once again, he was called upon for a bedtime story. This one was about the storm. Kate listened with tense excitement, as if the story might end with him drowned in the sea, despite the fact that he was sitting right in front of her. With Sarah, the subject of the previous night did not come up. This was their way. A lot was said by saying nothing. She also seemed distracted. Michael assumed that something had happened at the hospital and let it go at that. In the morning, he left the apartment before anyone else was awake. The old man was waiting for him.
The maestro has done it, he declared.
He led Michael to a CRT. His hands scurried over the keyboard. A glowing map appeared on the screen.
The ship. Where?
I found it in Galveston Bay at the mouth of the ship channel.
Long way from home.
The maestro walked Michael through the data. Departing from Hong Kong in mid-March, the Bergensfjord had sailed to Hawaii, then passed through the Panama Canal into the Atlantic. According to the timeline Michael had established from the newspaper, that much would have occurred before the outbreak of the Easter virus. They had made port in the Canary Islands, perhaps to refuel, then continued north. At this point, the data changed. The ship had traveled in circles up and down the coast of northern Europe. A brief foray to the Strait of Gibraltar, then it reversed course without entering the Mediterranean and returned to Tenerife. Several weeks elapsed, and they set sail again. The epidemic would have been widespread by this time. They passed through the Strait of Magellan and headed north toward the equator. In mid-ocean, the ship appeared to stop. After 2 motionless weeks, the data ended.
Can we tell where they were headed? Michael asked.
Another screen of data appeared. These were course plottings, the maestro explained. He scrolled down the page and directed Michael's attention to the last one.
Can you back that up for me? Michael asked.
Already done. The old man produced a flash drive from his apron. Michael put it in his pocket.
The maestro is curious.
Why so important?
I was thinking of taking a vacation.
The maestro has already checked. Empty ocean. Nothing there. His pale eyebrows lifted.
But something, perhaps.
The man was no fool.
Perhaps, said Michael.
He left Sarah a note. Sorry to run. Visiting an old friend. Hope to be back in a few days. The second transport to the Orange Zone left at 0900. Michael rode it to the end of the line, got off, and waited as the bus drove away. The posted sign read, "You are entering the red zone. Proceed at own risk. When in doubt, run."
If you only knew, he thought. Then he began to walk.
11. Sarah returned to the orphanage before the start of her morning shift. Sister Peg greeted her at the door.
"How is she doing?" Sarah asked.
The woman looked more harried than usual. It had been a long night for her.
"Not very well, I'm afraid."
Pim had woken up screaming. Her howls were so loud that they had awakened the entire dormitory. For the time being, they had put her in Sister Peg's quarters.
"We've had abused children before, but nothing so extreme. Another night like that."
Sister Peg led Sarah to her room, a monastic space with just the bare-bones necessities. The only decoration was a large cross on the wall. Pim was awake and sitting on the bed with her knees tight to her chest. But as Sarah entered, some of the tension released from her face.
"Here is an ally, someone who knows."
"I'll be outside if you need me," Sister Peg said. Sarah sat on the bed. The grime was gone, the mats in her hair teased straight or cut away. The sisters had dressed her in a plain wool tunic.
"How are you feeling today?" Sarah wrote on the chalkboard.
"Okay."
"Sister said you couldn't sleep."
Pim shook her head. Sarah explained to Pim that she needed to change her dressings. The girl flinched as Sarah eased away the bandages, but made no sound. Sarah applied antibiotic salve and a cream of cooling aloe and rewrapped her.
"I'm sorry if that hurt."
Pim shrugged.
Sarah looked her in the eye. "It will be okay," she wrote.
Then, when the girl did nothing,
"It gets better." "No more nightmares?"
Sarah shook her head.
"No." "How?"
There was, of course, the easy thing to say, "Give it time." But that wasn't the truth, or at least not the whole truth.
What took the pain away, Sarah knew, was other people. Hollis, and Kate, and being a family.
"It just does," she wrote. It was nearly 0800. Sarah had to leave, though she didn't want to. She packed up her kit and wrote,
"I have to go now. Try to rest. The sisters will take care of you."
"Come back?" Pim wrote. Sarah nodded.
"Do you swear?"
Pim was looking at her intently. People had been throwing her away her entire life. Why should Sarah be different?
"Yes," she said, and crossed her heart. "I swear."
Sister Peg was waiting for Sarah in the hall.
"How is she?"
The day had only just started, yet Sarah felt completely drained.
"The wounds on her back aren't the real problem. I wouldn't be surprised if she has more nights like that.
Is there any chance of finding a relative? Somebody who can take her in?"
"I think that would be the worst thing for her."
Sister Peg nodded.
"Yes, of course. That was stupid of me."
Sarah gave the woman a roll of gauze, boiled cloth pads, and a jar of ointment.
"Change her dressings every 12 hours. There's no sign of infection, but if anything starts to look worse, or she gets a fever, send for me right away."
Sister Peg was frowning at the objects in her hand. Then, brightening a little, she looked up.
"I meant to thank you for the other night. It was nice to get out. I should do it more often."
"Peter was happy to have you there."
"Caleb has grown so much. Kate, too. Sometimes it's easy to forget how lucky we are."
"Then you see something like this." She let the thought pass.
"I'd better get back to the children.
Where would they be without mean old Sister Peg?
It's a good act, if you don't mind my saying so."
"Does it show?
I'm really just an old softy at heart."
She walked Sarah out. At the doorway, Sarah paused.
"Let me ask you something. In the course of a year, say, how many children get adopted?"
"In a year?"
The woman seemed startled by the question. Zero? None at all? It happens, but very rarely. And it's never the older children, if that's what you're asking. Sometimes a baby will be left here, and a relative will come and claim it within a few days. But once a child has been here a while, the odds are good they'll stay.
I didn't know.
Her eyes searched Sarah's face. The two of us aren't so very different, you know. 10 times a day our jobs give us good reason to cry. And yet we can't. We wouldn't be any use to anyone if we did. It was true, but it didn't make Sarah's heart feel any less heavy. Thank you, sister. She headed for the hospital. Her mood was bleak. As she entered the building, Wendy urgently waved her over to the desk.
There's somebody waiting for you.
A patient? The woman looked around to make sure she wasn't overheard. She lowered her voice to a whisper.
He says he's from the census office.
Uh-oh, thought Sarah. That was fast.
Where is he?
I told him to wait, but he went to look for you on the ward. Jenny's with him.
You let Jenny talk to him? Are you nuts? There wasn't anything I could do. She was standing right there when he asked for you.
Wendy lowered her voice again.
It's about that woman with the abruption, isn't it?
Let's hope not. At the door to the ward, Sarah took a clean smock from the shelf. 2 things worked in her favor. The first was her rank. She was a doctor, and although she didn't like to do it, she could throw her weight around if she had to. A certain peremptory tone, veiled or not-so-veiled references to unnamed persons of substantial influence, the mantle of the higher calling, busy day, lives to save. Sarah had learned the tricks. Second, she hadn't done anything illegal. Failing to file the proper paperwork was not a crime, more like an error. She was safe, more or less, but this wouldn't help Carlos or his family. Once the fraud was discovered, Grace would be taken away. She stepped into the ward. Jenny was standing with a man who possessed the unmistakable look of a bureaucrat. Soft, balding, and flat-footed, with pasty skin that rarely saw sunshine. Jenny's glance met hers with a look of barely concealed panic.
Help.
Sarah, she began.
This is...
She didn't let the girl finish.
Jenny, could you please check the laundry for blankets? I think we're running low.
We are? Now, please. She scurried away.
I'm Dr. Wilson, Sarah said to the man. What is this about?
The man cleared his throat. He seemed a little nervous.
Good.
There was a woman who delivered a girl here 4 nights ago. He fumbled through the papers he was holding. Sally Jimenez, I believe you were the doctor on duty.
And you are?
Joe English. I'm from the census office.
I have a lot of patients, Mr. English.
She pretended to think.
Oh, yes, I remember. A healthy girl.
Is there an issue?
No birthright certificate was filed with the census form. The woman has 2 sons.
I'm sure I took care of it. You'll have to check again.
I spent all yesterday looking for it. It definitely wasn't sent to my office.
Your office never makes mistakes? Loses paperwork?
We're very thorough, Dr. Wilson. According to the nurse at the desk, Mrs. Jimenez was released 3 days ago. We always talk to the family first, but they don't seem to be home. Her husband hasn't been to work since the birth.
Dumb move, Carlos, Sarah thought. I can't be responsible for people once they leave here.
But you are responsible for filing the proper documentation. Without a valid birthright, I'm going to have to move her case up the line.
Well, I'm sure there was one. You're mistaken. Is that all? I'm very busy here. He regarded her for an uncomfortably long moment. For now, Dr. Wilson. Wherever the Jimenez family had gone, Sarah knew it wouldn't take long for the census office to track them down. There were only so many places to hide. She tried to put them out of her mind. She'd done her best to help, and the situation was out of her hands. Sister Peg was right. She had a job to do. It was important, and she was good at it. That was what mattered most. In the middle of the night, she awoke with the feeling that a powerful dream had ejected her from sleep. She rose and checked on Kate. She felt certain that her daughter had been in this dream, if peripherally. She had not been the focus. Rather, a witness, almost a judge. Sarah sat on the edge of her daughter's cot and watched the night pass through her. The girl was deeply asleep, her lips slightly parted, her chest expanding and contracting with long, even breaths, filling the air with her unmistakable scent. At the homeland, in the time before Sarah had found her again, it was Kate's smell that had given her the strength to go on. She'd kept a baby curl in an envelope, hidden away in her bunk, and each night she had taken it out and pressed it to her face. This act was, Sarah knew, a form of prayer. Not that Kate was still alive, because she'd believed absolutely that her daughter was dead, but that wherever she was, wherever her spirit had gone, it felt like home.
"Is everything okay?"
Hollis was standing behind her. Kate stirred, rolled over, and then was quiet again.
"Come back to bed," he whispered.
"I can sleep in. I'm on second shift." Hollis said nothing.
"All right," she said.
When dawn came, Sarah was wide awake. Hollis told her to stay in bed, but she got up anyway. She wouldn't return from the hospital until after dinner and wanted to take Kate to school. She was half drunk with exhaustion, although this fact did not seem like a compromising influence on her judgment, but a source of clarity. At the door of the school, she hugged her daughter tightly. It did not seem so long ago that Sarah had needed to kneel to do this. Now the crown of Kate's head reached Sarah's chest.
"Mom?"
The hug had gone on for some time.
"Sorry."
Sarah released her. The other children were streaming past. She realized what she was feeling. She was happy. A weight had lifted from her heart.
"Go on, kiddo," she said. "I'll see you later."
The records office opened at 9 o'clock. Sarah waited on the steps in the dappled shade of a live oak. It was a pleasant summer morning. People were striding past. How quickly life could change, she thought. When the clerk unlocked the door, Sarah rose and followed the woman inside. She was older, with a pleasant, weathered face and a row of bright false teeth. She took her time situating herself behind the counter before looking Sarah's way, pretending to notice her for the first time.
"Can I help you?"
"I need to transfer a birthright."
The clerk licked her fingers and removed a form from a slotted shelf, then placed it on the counter and dipped her quill in a bottle of ink.
"Whose?"
"Mine."
The woman's pen halted over the paper. She raised her face with an expression of concern.
"You seem young, honey. Are you sure?"
"Please, can we just do this?"
Sarah sent the form to the census office with a note attached.
"Sorry, found it after all," and went to the hospital.
The day passed quickly. Hollis was still awake when she got home. She waited until they were in bed to make her announcement.
"I want to have another child."
He rose on his elbows and turned toward her.
"Sarah, we've been through this. You know we can't."
She kissed him, long and tenderly, then drew back to meet his eyes.
"Actually," she said,
"that's not exactly true." 12. 10 moves, and Caleb had Peter completely boxed in. A feint with a rook, a knight cruelly sacrificed, and the enemy forces swarmed over him.
"How the heck did you do that?"
Peter didn't really mind, though it would be nice to win once in a while. The last time he'd beaten Caleb, the boy had had a nasty cold and had dozed off midway through the game. Even then, Peter had barely eked out the victory.
"It's easy. You think I'm on defense, but I'm not."
"Laying a trap." The boy shrugged.
"It's like a trap in your head.
I make you see the game the way I need you to. He was setting up the pieces again. One victory was not enough for the night. What did the soldier want? Caleb had a way of changing the subject so abruptly that sometimes Peter struggled to keep up. It was about a job, actually.
What kind?
To tell you the truth, I'm not really sure. He shrugged and looked at the board. It's not important. Don't worry about it. I'm not going anywhere. They were listlessly moving pawns. I still want to be a soldier, you know, the boy said. Like you were. From time to time, the boy brought this up. Peter's feelings were mixed. On the one hand, he had a parent's intense desire to keep Caleb away from any danger. But he also felt flattered. The boy was, after all, expressing interest in the same life he had chosen. Well, you'd be good at it. Do you miss it? Sometimes. I liked my men. I had good friends. But I'd rather be here with you. Plus, it looks like those days are over. Not much need for an army when there's nobody to fight. Everything else seems like it would be boring. Boredom is underrated, believe me. They played in silence. Somebody asked me about you, Caleb said. A kid at school. What was the question? Caleb squinted at the board, reached toward his bishop, stopped, and moved his queen one space forward. Just what it's like, you being my dad? He knew a lot about you. Which kid was this? His name is Julio. He wasn't one of Caleb's usual friends. What did you tell him? I told him you worked on roofs all day. For once, Peter held Caleb to a draw. He put the boy to bed and poured himself a drink from Hollis's flask. Caleb's words had stung a little. Peter wasn't truly tempted by Sanchez's offer, but the whole thing had left a bad taste in his mouth. The woman's manipulation was transparent, as it was meant to be. That was the genius of it. She had simultaneously aroused his natural sense of duty and made it clear that she was not a woman to be messed with. I'll have you in the end, Mr. Jackson. Just you try, he thought. I'll be right here, reminding my kid to brush his teeth. They were re-roofing an old mission close to the center of town. Empty for decades, it was now being converted to apartments. Peter's crew had spent 2 weeks dismantling the rotted belfry and had begun to strip off the old slates. The roof was steeply pitched. They worked on 12-inch-wide horizontal boards, called cleats, anchored by metal brackets nailed into the sheeting and spaced at 6-foot intervals. A pair of ladders, lying flush with the roof at the ends of the cleats, acted as staircases connecting them. All morning, they worked shirtless in the heat. Peter was on the uppermost cleat with two others, Jock Alvado and Sam Fotopoulos, who went by the name Photo. Photo had worked construction for years, but Jock had been there just a couple of months. He was young, 17 or so, with a narrow, acneed face and long, greasy hair he wore in a ponytail. Nobody liked him. His movements were too sudden, and he talked too much. It was an unwritten rule of the roofing crews not to remark on the danger. It was a form of respect. Looking down, Jock liked to say stupid things like, "Wow, that would hurt," and "That would most definitely fuck a person up." At noon, they broke for lunch. Climbing down was too much trouble, so they ate where they were. Jock was talking about a girl he had seen in the market, but Peter was barely listening. The sounds of the city drifted upward in an aural haze. From time to time, a bird floated past. "Let's get back to it," Photo said. They were using pry bars and mallets to chip out the old tiles. Peter and Photo moved to the third cleat. Jock was working below them to the right. He was still talking about the woman. Her hair, a certain way she walked, a look that passed between them. "Will he ever shut up?" Photo said. He was a thick, muscular man, his black beard sprinkled with gray. "I think he just likes the sound of his own voice. I'm gonna throw his ass off this roof, I swear." Photo glanced up, squinting into the sun. "Looks like we missed a couple." Several tiles remained along the ridgeline. Peter slid his bar and mallet into his tool belt.
I'll go.
Forget it. Loverboy can do it.
He yelled down, Jock, get up there.
I'm not the one who missed those. That was Jackson's section.
It's yours now.
Fine, the boy huffed. Whatever you say. Jock unclipped his harness, scrambled up the ladder to the uppermost cleat, and wedged his pry bar under one of the tiles. As he lifted the mallet to strike, Peter realized he was straight above them.
Wait a sec.
The tile popped free. It sang past, narrowly missing Photo's head.
You idiot!
Sorry, I didn't see you there.
Where did you think we were?
Photo said.
You did that on purpose. And clip in, for Christ's sake.
It was an accident, Jock said. Calm down. You'll have to move. They shifted to the side. Jock finished up and had begun to climb down when Peter heard a pop. Jock let out a yelp. A second pop, and with a loud clatter, the ladder rocketed down the roof with Jock still attached. At the last second, he lunged clear and began to slide down the roof on his belly. After his first cry, he hadn't made a sound. His hands were madly searching for something to grab hold of, his toes digging into the tiles to slow his descent. Nobody had ever fallen that Peter knew of. Suddenly, this seemed not possible, but inevitable. Jock was the one chosen. 10 feet from the edge, his body halted. His hand had found something. A rusty spike.
Help!
Peter unclipped and scrambled down to the lowest cleat. Gripping a bracket, he leaned out.
Take my hand.
The boy was frozen with terror. His right hand was clutching the spike, his left gripping the edge of a tile. Every inch of him was pressed to the surface.
If I move, I'll fall.
No, you won't. Far below, people had stopped on the street to look.
Photo, toss me my safety line, Peter said. It won't reach. I'll have to reset the anchor.
The spike was bending under Jock's weight.
Oh, God, I'm slipping.
Stop squirming.
Photo, hurry up with that rope.
Down it came. Peter had no time to clip in. The boy was about to fall. As Photo pulled the line taut through the block, Peter wrapped it around his forearm and lunged toward Jock. The spike broke loose. Jock began to slide.
I've got you, Peter yelled. Hold on!
Peter had him by the wrist. Jock's feet were inches from the edge.
Find something to grip, Peter said. There's nothing.
Peter didn't know how much longer he could hold him.
Photo, can you pull us up? You're too heavy. Tie it off and get down here with some brackets.
A small crowd had gathered on the street. Many were pointing upward. The distance to the ground had enlarged, becoming an infinite space that would swallow them whole. A few seconds passed. Then Photo was moving across the cleat above them.
What do you want me to do?
Peter said, Jock, there's a small lip at the edge just below you. Try to find it with your feet.
It's not there.
Yes, it is. I'm looking right at it. A moment later, Jock said,
Okay, got it.
Take a deep breath, okay?
I'm going to have to let you go for a second.
Jock tightened his grip on Peter's wrist.
Are you kidding me?
I can't get you up unless I do. Just lie still. I guarantee the lip will hold you if you don't move. The man had no choice. Slowly he released his grip.
Photo, toss me a bracket.
Peter caught it with his free hand, wedged it under a seam in the tiles, removed a nail from his tool belt, and pressed it into the gap until it bit. 3 strokes of the mallet drove it home. He set the second nail, then lowered himself a few feet.
Toss me another.
Please,
Jock moaned.
Hurry.
Deep breaths. This will all be over in a minute.
Peter set 3 more brackets in place.
Okay.
Carefully reach up and to your left. Got it? Jock's hand gripped the bracket.
Yeah. Jesus.
Now pull yourself up to the next one. Take your time. There's no hurry. Bracket by bracket, Jock ascended. Peter followed him up. Jock was sitting on the cleat, gulping water from a canteen. Peter crouched beside him.
Okay?
Jock nodded vaguely. His face was pale, his hands trembling. Just take a minute, Peter said.
Hell. Take the whole day, said Photo. Take the rest of your life.
Jock was staring into space. Though he wasn't really seeing anything, Peter guessed.
Try to relax, Peter said.
Jock glanced down at Peter's harness.
You weren't clipped in?
There wasn't time.
So you just did all that?
Holding the rope.
It worked, didn't it?
Jock looked away.
I thought I was dead for sure.
You know what gets me? Photo said. That little shit didn't even thank you.
They'd knocked off early. The two of them were sitting on the front steps passing a flask. They'd seen the last of Jock. He'd turned in his tool belt and walked off.
That was smart with the brackets, Photo continued. I wouldn't have thought of that.
You might have. I just got there first.
That kid is fucking lucky is all I have to say.
And look at you. Not even rattled.
It was true. He'd felt invincible, his mind perfectly focused, his thoughts clear as ice.
In fact, there was no lip at the edge of the roof. The surface was perfectly smooth.
I make you see the game the way I need you to.
Photo capped the flask and got to his feet.
So I guess I'll see you tomorrow.
Actually, I think that's it for me, Peter said. Photo stared at him, then gave a quiet chuckle.
Anybody else, I'd figure they were worried about getting killed. You'd probably like it if somebody fell every day so you could catch them.
What will you do instead?
Somebody's offered me a job. I thought I wasn't interested, but maybe I am.
The man nodded evenly.
Whatever it is, it's got to be more interesting than this.
It's true what they say about you.
They shook hands.
Good luck to you, Jackson.
Peter watched him go, then walked to the Capitol.
As he entered Sanchez's office, she glanced up from her papers.
Mr. Jackson, that was fast. I thought I was going to have to work a little harder.
Two conditions. Actually, three.
The first is your son, of course. I've given you my word. What else?
I want direct access to you. No middlemen.
What about Chase? The man's my chief of staff.
Just you.
She thought only a moment. If that's what it takes.
What's the third?
Don't make me wear a necktie.
The sun had just set when Michael knocked on the door of Greer's cabin. There was no light inside, no sound.
Well, I've walked too long to wait out here, he thought. I'm sure Lucius won't mind.
He put his bag on the floor and lit the lamp. He looked around.
Greer's pictures. How many were there? 50? 100?
He stepped closer.
Yes, his memory had not betrayed him.
Some were hasty sketches. Others had obviously required hours of focused labor. Michael selected one of the paintings, untacked it from the wall, and laid it on the table. A mountainous island, bathed in green, seen from the bow of a ship which was just visible at the bottom edge. The sky above and behind the island was a deep twilight blue. At its center, at 45 degrees to the horizon, was a constellation of 5 stars. The door flew open. Greer stood at the threshold, pointing a rifle at Michael's head.
Flyers, put that down, Michael said.
Greer lowered the gun.
It's not loaded anyway.
Good to know. Michael tapped the paper with his finger.
Remember when I said you should tell me about these?
Greer nodded.
Now would be the time.
The constellation was the Southern Cross, the most distinctive feature of the night sky south of the equator. Michael showed Greer the newspaper, which the man read without reaction, as if its contents came as no surprise to him. He described the Bergensfjord and the bodies he'd found. He read the captain's letter aloud, the first time he had done this. It felt very different to speak the words, as if he were not overhearing a conversation, but enacting it. For the first time, he glimpsed what the man had intended by writing a letter that could never be sent. It imparted a kind of permanence to the words and the emotions they contained. Not a letter, but an epitaph. Michael saved the data from the Bergensfjord's navigational computer for last. The ship's destination had been a region of the South Pacific, roughly halfway between northern New Zealand and the Cook Islands. Michael used the atlas to show Greer. When the ship's engines had failed, they had been 1,500 miles north-northeast of their goal, traveling in the equatorial currents.
"So how did it end up in Galveston?" Greer asked.
"It shouldn't have. It should have sunk, just like the captain said."
"Yet it didn't."
Michael frowned.
"It's possible the currents could have pushed it here. I don't really know much about it.
I'll tell you one thing it means. There's no barrier, and never was." Lucius looked at the newspaper again. He pointed midway down the page.
"This here, about the virus having an avian source. Birds."
"I'm familiar with the word, Michael. Does it mean the virus could still be out there?"
"If they're carriers, it might be. Sounds like the people in charge never figured it out, though."
"In rare instances," Greer read aloud, "victims of the illness have exhibited the transformative effects of the North American strain, including a marked increase in aggressiveness. But whether any of these individuals have survived past the 36-hour threshold is not known."
That got my attention, too.
"Are they talking about virals?"
"If so, they're a different strain."
"Meaning they could still be alive. Killing the 12 wouldn't have affected them."
Michael didn't say anything.
"Good God."
"You want to know what's funny?" Michael said. "Maybe funny's not the right word. The world quarantined us and left us to die. In the end, it's the only reason we're still here."
Greer rose from the table and fetched a whiskey bottle from the shelf. He poured two glasses, handed one to Michael, and sipped. Michael did the same.
"Think about it, Lucius. That ship traveled halfway around the world, never bumping into anything, never running aground, never down-flooding in a storm. Somehow it manages to make its way perfectly intact into Galveston Bay right under our noses. What are the odds?"
"Not good, I'd say."
"So you tell me what it's doing here. You're the one who drew those pictures."
Greer poured more into his glass, but didn't drink it. He was silent for a moment, then said,
"It's what I saw."
"What do you mean, saw?"
"It's difficult to explain."
"None of this is easy, Lucius." Greer was staring into his glass, turning it around on the tabletop.
"I was in the desert. Don't ask me what I was doing there. It's a long story. I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for days. Something happened to me in the night. I'm not really sure what to call it. I guess it was a dream, though it was stronger than that, more real."
"This image, you mean? The island, the 5 stars.
Lucius nodded. "I was on a ship. I could feel it moving under me. I could hear the waves, smell the salt.
Was it the Bergensfjord?"
He shook his head. "All I know is it was big."
"Were you alone?"
"There may have been other people there, but I couldn't see them. I couldn't turn around."
Greer looked at him pointedly.
"Michael, are you thinking what I think you're thinking?"
"That depends."
"That the ship is meant for us. That we're supposed to go to the island."
"How else can you explain it?"
"I can't."
He frowned skeptically. "This isn't at all like you. To put so much faith in a picture drawn by a crazy man."
For a moment, neither man spoke. Michael sipped his whiskey.
"This ship," Greer said. "Will it float?"
"I don't know how much damage there is below the waterline. The lower decks are flooded,
but the engine compartment's dry. Can you fix it? Maybe, but it'd take an army.